Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Here till 5 a.m., Steve Grzanich with your opening bell at 5. And Steve Cochran back this morning at 6 o'clock. Triple play Thursday if you want to sneak one in, 312-981-7200. We are going to talk about surprisingly classic movie moments that were indeed improvised. And we'll talk a little bit about that, classic movie moments that were improvised. And Esmeralda and I will go head-to-head again and pop up video. Right now, though, we'd like to welcome back to the show our good friend, a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print. That's F-I-E-N. Dan Feinberg to talk TV. And we welcome Dan to the show. Hey, Dan.
How are you doing, Nick?
All right. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks.
All right.
Doing
good,
well.
Good. We've got a lot of TV stuff to talk about. Is there anything that, you know, I always jump right in. Is there anything that you want to lead with here? Is there anything TV stuff that you wanted to talk about? Anything new?
Oh, I'm sure that we'll be able to get to everything. I just want to make sure that at some point we get to the new Gilmore Girls episodes that are premiering next week, because we're not going to talk before Thanksgiving, so right. I want to make sure we get to it.
Okay, good, because that's what I want to lead with, because I'm not planning on leaving my apartment from Black Friday till I'm done. It's how long is the series? 4 hours?
It's only 6 hours.
Oh, it's six. Okay.
Four episodes, 90 minutes apiece, so really you can start watching it at midnight and you'll be done by morning.
Okay, good. Good, because that's my plan.
I'm easy.
So, Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life, how is it?
It is better than the seventh season. The first three episodes or seasons are maybe a little bit clunkier than I would have liked, but I felt like the last of the four seasons, installments, however you want to describe it, because it's divided up by season. So it starts winter, spring, summer, fall. So, it's calling it seasons and gets confusing. But the last of them is the one that you can tell Amy Sherman-Palladino, the series creator, that she wanted to get to.
Yeah.
So basically, that is satisfying. That brings it home. There are bumpy patches before that.
Okay. As a massive fan of Gilmore Girls, Dan, I have to say that I was extraordinarily disappointed with season 7. And in fact, a bit angry during. You know, I mean, she had left the show. She left the show at season 7? Correct.
She left the show between season 6 and 7, which was also when the WB ceased to exist and the CW came into being. And, I mean, a lot of people forget that the sixth season was also really bumpy, and the place where the sixth season ends is particularly mm-hmm. bumpy, mm-hmm. and that's on Amy Sherman-Palladino as well. So the seventh season is in no way her fault, and you can tell that. But she's back here for this. The characters sound like the characters again, and that's very, very important.
And is everybody, I mean, obviously Edward Herman, and it's the death of Richard that launches the show, correct?
It doesn't really. It's just it's a piece of the puzzle or the tapestry or the ongoing storyline. It's not the thing that brings anything together, but it certainly is a thing that's in the backdrop of everything.
Okay.
It is definitely an emotional undercurrent.
Okay. And it's, besides Edward Herman, is everybody back?
Just about everybody. There are a few people who are missing, and I don't want to necessarily spoil who
okay.
some of them are, but
mm-hmm.
certainly one of them is Chad Michael Murray.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a little bit funny because Tristan is mentioned, but it is not Chad Michael Murray who appears in the 1 second shot of that character.
Was that right? Oh, wow.
It's a thing to watch out for. But yes, most of the characters you expect to be back will be back. Not spoiling specifics on them. A number of characters you probably don't expect to have back are also back. There are a lot of people back, and it's actually probably a bit too much, because in any normal four-episode return of the series, you wouldn't need to have 50 returning characters come by and wave and say, "Hi, it's me again." But because she doesn't know when she's going to get to do the show again, if ever, Yeah. Everybody has to come back.
And, you know, I gotta say that this thing is probably going to, you know, this. I have a feeling that this thing is going to be huge for Netflix. I mean, I know so many people who are unbelievably excited, and of course, myself included, that this thing is coming back.
I assume it will be very big. There's no way of knowing because Netflix does not tell us these things. And then down the road, we get kind of suspect numbers via different shady services that maybe or maybe don't actually record anything. So we'll get fake numbers a couple months down the road, and we can judge them as we will. But yeah, I assume this will be pretty huge. I mean, keep in mind, this is a show that was never a big hit. Oh, because it was on, you know, it was on little networks. Yeah. It was on the WB and the CW. So it was never huge, but it's had all of these years of people being able to catch up in all of these different digital formats, and certainly on Netflix for a while, and but it's been on a number of services. And I think the audience for it has just grown, and I think there's an appetite.
I agree with you, because I was on board with this with Gilmore Girls from episode one. I was with them from the first season, from the first episode, and I watched it religiously, and I loved it. And I would, you know how I get when I'm passionate about something on my show. I talk about it a lot, you know, like Atlanta and Better Things, which we'll get to. I noticed that, you know, I mean, I'm personally responsible for a lot of people watching the show. Because I went out of my way to tell people to watch Gilmore Girls. And I can't tell you the number of people who have said, I never would have watched the show had you not talked about it. And they love it. And I've noticed over the years, the popularity of the show and people's knowledge of the show has grown since it was canceled. And I agree with you 100%. It's become much bigger than it was when it was airing.
Yeah, and I think that this was well set up to both build an appetite over the course of the year that people were able to talk about it. But also, it is dropping on a day where people are mostly going to be either doing their shopping or recovering from Thanksgiving or whatever it is that people do on Black Friday. And I think that there will be a lot of people who are home and available and will be streaming them some Netflix that morning.
Yeah. Now, normally on a Friday morning, I would be on the air. But I'm on vacation for the week for Thanksgiving, so right at midnight, boom, that's my plan. That's my plan, is just sitting on the couch watching Gilmore Girls for 6 hours. So
I think it's a good plan. I think it's a safe plan, and stay off of social media, because there are going to be some morons out there who are going to go and fast forward to the end of the fourth episode, because Amy Sherman-Palladino has always talked about how she always knew what the quote unquote last four words were.
Yeah.
And there will be people out there who are going to go and find out those four words within 10 minutes, and they're going to tweet it and all of that obnoxious stuff.
Right.
And avoid those people.
I will. Well, you know, I mean, my plan is to just, you know, the social media goes off from midnight till 6 a.m. That's my plan till I get through the entire thing, man. I am so excited about this.
It's a good idea.
Yeah.
It's a good idea because someone out there is going to ruin it or try to ruin it or whatever. And it's, you know, I don't know that it's this sacred thing that it will impact whether or not you can enjoy the other 3 and 95% of the episodes, but
right.
Still, you don't want to have that
absolutely
spoiled.
No, I don't want it ruined at all. I mentioned Atlanta and I mentioned Better Things. Better Things ended its first season this last week, and you wrote a piece about the joys of formula-free comedy. Talk a little bit about that.
I just talked a bit about how the network motto is that you have to be repeatable. And that's how network TV comedy works. It's very built on a structure that has to be repeatable 22 times a year. And as anyone who's a funny person out there who writes anything knows, it's hard to do that reliably. And the network model requires a churn. It requires doing things a lot frequently the same. And the interesting thing about both Atlanta and Better Things for me is that they went the opposite of that. It's not repeatable. The formula is different every single week, and that's exciting. And it's auteur comedy TV, and Pamela Adlon and Donald Glover and Louis C.K., who executive produces Better Things with Pamela Adlon, these are people who do something different. And I think it's a special thing and a notable thing. And certainly no one would accuse us of not telling people about Atlanta and Better Things in recent weeks. But I still think it's an important thing that we tell people about these shows, because they're special.
They are special, man. And Better Things, the final episode of Better Things, made me tear up. You know, and you know, you get any time a show ends with Alice Cooper, it makes me happy. I just thought it was great, and I mean, Pamela Adlon's got to be a lock for a nomination, right?
For a nomination, I would think so. Yeah. I would assume. I don't necessarily, you know, keep in mind, this is, as always, this is the Julia Louis-Dreyfus category,
and that's right.
We always say can't begrudge her. She deserves whatever she gets. But I think that Pamela Adlon ought to be in that conversation. She's definitely good enough. The show is definitely good enough. And, it, you know, recognizing her for any one thing would be a recognition for all the other things she does on the show, because she writes it, she produces it, she directed a couple episodes, et cetera. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's just great. And again, one more time, if you've not watched Atlanta or Better Things, they're both on FX. You can get them on FX now, and they're available on demand. And I can't recommend them highly enough.
Just two great first seasons, and 10 episodes apiece, half an hour apiece per episode. So easy to catch up. And, you know, if after watching 6 hours of Gilmore Girls on Black Friday, you feel like you need something else to do for 5 hours. Either one of them's a good start.
You got it. Okay, hang on a second, okay, Dan?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. He is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. We're talking TV. We've got a couple of texts here from listeners who have a couple of questions about TV. We'll get to those as well. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we'll be back to talk more TV right after this. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trip Tower, here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. Triple Play Thursday, got time for a couple of those if you want to sneak in, 312-981-7200. My guest right now is Dan Feinberg. He joins us every couple of weeks. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, and we welcome Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you much.
You know, someone had a text. They texted in a question from the 847 area code that says, can you ask Dan about Goliath on Amazon? It looks interesting. This is a Billy Bob Thornton show.
It is indeed interesting. I don't know if it's necessarily good. It is created by David E. Kelley, who, of course, has been behind so many classic legal TV shows. And this is his first entree into the streaming world. And Amazon's been promoting it pretty heavily.
Yeah.
I can't think of another Amazon show that's gotten as much TV advertising as Goliath.
I totally agree with you. It's everywhere.
I don't know what to make of it. I guess, you know, it's somewhere in between. A, they're worried that they won't get their money back if they don't find a way to get people to actually watch this one, and B, them thinking this is a big deal for them. And it stars Billy Bob Thornton, and so obviously that's a pretty big deal. Billy Bob Thornton, William Hurt, Maria Bello, and then a bunch of other people who you recognize. And for me, the legal plot itself is just the basic underdog legal plot, you know, little man, little lawyer who lost his way, used to be the greatest of all time, lost it all in drinking and whatever, gets one last chance to go up against the big boys, to go up against the Goliath, as it were. And of course, it's the law firm that let him go many years ago. It's his chance for revenge, but can he get his mojo back? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, if you've read a John Grisham book, you've seen the plot 20 different times with 20 different spins. And it's not particularly interesting. And I honestly couldn't tell you, I could not, a couple weeks after watching the episodes, tell you what the core plot is beyond the underdog legal story. But Billy Bob Thornton's just fun to watch. And it's as simple as that. He is just entertaining to watch, and he is playing a role that is well tailored for his particular quirky thing. And David E. Kelley is enjoying swearing a lot, because he hasn't been able to do that on network TV. And Billy Bob Thornton swears well. And so these are all reasons to watch the show. I wish the show itself around Billy Bob were better. But if you're curious about watching Billy Bob Thornton do a legal drama for you know, 8 episodes, which is not a huge commitment, it's not bad at that. And that would be what I would say. Not a great show, but definitely, if it looks like something you're interested in, chances are good you'll probably be interested in it.
Okay. 847 area code. There you go. Goliath on Amazon. And, Billy Bob Thornton is good at swearing, and we get to see him swear like a madman in a couple of weeks with Bad Santa 2.
I would like for that to be good. I have nervousness about it, but I would like for it to be good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in the minority. I'm not a fan of the first movie at all. I also think it's very weird that the director of Mean Girls is directing this one. I don't know why I find that strange, but I do.
So. Mark Waters has had an interesting career path.
Yes.
And so this makes, I guess, as much sense as anything. I like him so much in Bad Santa. Like, there's a whole movie around him. I mostly like him, and I like Lauren Graham.
Yeah.
And so one of those two people, I believe, isn't in this. So
right.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would like for it to be good, and if it's not, I won't be crushed or anything.
Right.
But.
Okay.
You know, I don't like it when they come back unnecessarily and pointlessly for a sequel, and then also ruin memories of it.
So. It's also been 13 years since that movie came out.
It's been a very long time,
and it seems like that's a trend too, Dan. I mean, we're talking movies here really quickly, but it seems like this has been a year and a half of sequels that nobody wanted from movies that were 15, 20 years old.
And then everyone gets confused and perplexed when the box office return suggests that no one wanted the movie that everyone knew that no one wanted. It's
right.
Like, why bother? Why be shocked when the Independence Day sequel, 12 years after when anyone wanted an Independence Day sequel, and with most of the people who you wanted in an Independence Day sequel not there, turns out not to make money? Why would anyone be surprised by that?
Yeah.
But, we'll be surprised by it.
Okay. All right. Now, look, recently, before we get back to some of the TV stuff that we want to talk about here, you moderated a Q&A with John Lithgow. How was that?
That was a lot of fun. This is building up to awards season in Los Angeles, and so they do lots of these kind of get-togethers, and this was a Screen Actors Guild event that I did, and John Lithgow is, of course, getting ready to presumably be nominated for many things for Netflix's The Crown, in which he plays Winston Churchill and is really just so terrific in it. And I recommend The Crown highly, but his performance in it is extra good. And it was just great to sit down with him because he is such a charming and smart and funny guy. And he's great at telling stories, and he does voices, and he plays it up, and it was really just tremendously fun to talk to him, and in a room full of actors who were basically hanging on his every word because, you know, he's John Lithgow. I mean, he's, you know, 5-time Emmy winner, 2-time Tony winner, more awards than you can count. That was a great pleasure. I really enjoyed doing that.
That sounds like it must have been fun. And The Crown, tell everybody again where people can see The Crown.
It's on Netflix, and the 10-episode first season is all up. And it, you know, you might not think you care about the life of Queen Elizabeth II, not to be confused with the Cate Blanchett Queen Elizabeth.
Right.
And the answer is you probably maybe do, or you may be interested in things about her that you didn't know you were interested in. It's an interesting look at royal protocol, at the monarchy, in a changing world, and it's much more compelling than you would think it is. It's much more emotional. Jared Harris is phenomenal in the early episodes, playing the role that Colin Firth won an Oscar for in The King's Speech.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just, it's very good, and it moves along faster than you'd think it would, but it also probably, if people are feeling like they're about to start missing Downton Abbey as we approach the time when it normally would premiere in a year, this is another great showcase for British acting and production values and that kind of thing. It's a good series, and I think that probably it'll get many Golden Globe nominations when we get to that
mm-hmm.
in a few weeks.
Okay, great. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
For sure.
Got a break here for news, and when we come back afterwards, we'll talk more TV with Dan Feinberg. Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and my buddy and yours, the great Steve Cochran, at 6 a.m. for your morning drive. We've got We're going to talk a little bit about classic movie moments that were improvised. Esmeralda and I are going to go head-to-head on some pop-up video questions. But right now, we are in the middle of talking with our buddy Dan Feinberg, who is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. We got more TV to talk about. Let's welcome Dan back to the show. Hey, Dan.
How you doing, Nick?
All right. Let's talk about last week's SNL with Dave Chappelle as the host, Tribe Called Quest as the musical guest. I know you wrote about it. What did you think?
I thought it began very, very powerfully, and Kate McKinnon kind of as Hillary Clinton singing Hallelujah, paying tribute simultaneously to the crushed dreams of Hillary Clinton and her fans, but also paying tribute, of course, to Leonard Cohen.
Right.
I thought it was rather impressively powerful. Yeah. And heaven knows Hallelujah is not a song that we need more covers of.
Right.
It hit me hard in a way I didn't expect.
No, me too. I was crying. I was crying.
Exactly.
Yep. And monologue, Dave Chappelle's monologue, one of the best monologues I've ever seen in the history of that show, in my opinion.
There's sort of the genre of the stand-up monologue opening, and only a few people can do it. You know, Louis C.K. had a great one last year.
Yeah.
When good people take a chance to do basically 7 or 8 minutes of great stand-up in that position, it's really great. And I would prefer that to when they don't know what to do with the host, and the host does, like, I don't know, one of those Q&As from the audience where they ask stupid questions.
That's always, you know, that seems to be the go-to. You know what I mean? It's when they start, you know, I know it's like, okay, the writers were kind of had no idea what to do with this guest, so they're just going to do the Q&A with the wacky people in the audience bit.
Or they do a song where basically the host sings two or three lines, and then the cast comes out and sings around them to cover up that the star can't really do very much. that's not a particularly good version of an opening. But in this case, it was a great bit of stand-up in that Dave Chappelle had both things he wanted to say politically, but also really the last couple minutes, which were pretty much straightforward and not at all funny unless you enjoy a good Bradley Cooper joke. And let's be honest, who doesn't?
Right.
But yeah, it was heartfelt and emotional and thoughtful. Whether or not you agree with what he was saying or not, that's a different thing. It reached out, and the first 10 minutes between the cold open song and the monologue, it showed a lot of what SNL can do when SNL wants to do things right.
Yeah.
And I wish SNL wanted to do things right more often, but they did for 10 minutes.
And I thought that, well, I actually thought the first sketch was great too, the election night sketch with Chris Rock.
That was very good as well.
Yeah.
Where the show went from there was sort of off into the ether, and except for the musical performances were great too. And
they were great. So
really it was a good episode, because a good opening, a good monologue, two good sketches and a couple good musical performances, that's about as good as you can hope for from SNL. And the Tribe Called Quest performances were fantastic. And they were emotional too, with the tribute to Fight Dog in the first number and
absolutely,
all that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I thought it was a great episode overall, and it was kind of something that I needed. I think a lot of people needed. They really came out swinging, and it was an SNL that I was really curious about, you know, unlike after the election and everything. I was like, what are they going to do here? And I also think it was wise not to have Alec Baldwin come out and do his Trump.
I agree completely. I think that this was not going to be the right moment to get anyone to laugh about that. And it wasn't going to be the right moment for, among other reasons, because getting past the fact that SNL gave Trump his fall episode, I'm just never going to get past that.
I understand.
And they don't want to make me constantly think of that. And so in not bringing him out and not in any way drawing attention to how complicit they were in his election, that was a good move on their part.
Yeah.
And just having Kate McKinnon be fantastic, which she is, because she's both a great singer, which we knew because she's done things like that before,
right?
but just the way she pulled meaning from what is a gorgeous song, and we sometimes lose track of the different bits and pieces of it because, you know, you listen to the Jeff Buckley version, you're getting lost in the Jeff Buckley of it all.
Right.
And whether or not you're actually listening to the lyrics sometimes, I don't know that I am, because it's just his voice that's doing it. And the way she made those lyrics work for the circumstances, a tribute to the things it was a tribute to, I thought that was just special.
Yeah, I agree. All right, we have a, you know, we talk a lot here. We have a Rod Pyle is a guy, he's an author, and he's an outer space expert, and we have him on, you know, regularly to talk, you know, any kind of space news. And obviously a lot of people who listen to the show are into this kind of thing, and I'm wondering what you thought of Mars, which was the Ron Howard documentary thing, sort of documentary.
I like that as a description because it conveys just how hard it is to describe what this is. And what it is it's a six-hour National Geographic event series. And as you say, it is executive produced by Ron Howard and Brian Grazer and the Imagine people. And what it is it's half a scripted journey to Mars sci-fi series set in 2033 about the first manned mission to Mars, but then also half people in 2016, just a straight-up documentary with people like Neil deGrasse Tyson and Elon Musk and Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian, basically talking about the logistics of what it will take to get a hypothetical manned mission to Mars going. And so it's half and half, and it was frustrating for me because the documentary stuff is not revelatory or anything, but it's smart people talking about an interesting subject, and it works interestingly. But the scripted part is just a bad scripted Mars mission movie, and we've had enough good ones.
Yeah.
That I don't know that I needed that. And so I kind of wanted it to just be one thing and be one thing well, as opposed to being one thing reasonably well and one thing really uninterestingly. And I was interested in the documentary. I could have entirely done without the scripted bits.
And I don't really, I mean, has anybody ever done that before? Like kind of mixed documentary with like a fictional narrative? It just seems weird.
Well, it happens with you know, some occasionality in certain things. Like, for example, when National Geographic did the first of their Killing movies, when they did Killing Lincoln, it was half a reenactment of the killing of Lincoln and half talking head and documentary. And that, of course, is, you know, half scripted. And it's half reenactment and half documentary. So not really the same. A commenter on my Facebook page just brought up as a pretty basic example, Moby Dick, as being a text which is indeed half a fictional story about Ahab and Ishmael and Starbuck and all of that going after the great white whale. And every other chapter basically is quote-unquote documentary. It's historical and resource driven discussion of whales and whaling and the industry and all of that. So it's definitely something that is a tradition within fiction. It's just something that we don't see quite so often now in this format. And so it's funny to see the mix of big budget sci-fi mixed with basically no budget documentary.
Yeah.
And it doesn't wholly work here. And perhaps people need to do it more often.
I had never even thought about Moby Dick until it was brought up here.
No, and I hadn't either. When the commenter brought it up, I'm like, yeah, that's absolutely what this is.
Yeah.
And sure, why not? But it is not something that I would have thought of, but makes total sense. So kudos.
Is there anybody in the scripted version of note, like actors or actresses, that we would know?
There are people who people would find familiar. So the main actor, Olivier Martinez, who was in Unfaithful and a bunch of other stuff, is probably the most known actor, but he has like a nothing part. There's no purpose to him being there. Ben Cotton, who people would recognize from probably about 50 TV shows shot in Toronto and Vancouver. I mean, he's a character actor who's been in everything that is shot in Canada. And you would never know his name, but he's kind of the lead actor. But otherwise, no, not really.
Okay.
And that's fine. But it sort of reminds you of why so much of what The Martian was able to get away with came because of the stars. Right. How often a star can allow you to sketch out writing in sort of shorthand, and the star will fill in the gaps, or the star will make you believe that the shorthand is fully fleshed out because they can do that. And, you know, it's harder for non-A-list stars to do sometimes. And I guess this made it look and feel kind of realer and more immediate in that way. You're not distracted by seeing a star, but, you know, it goes both ways, positive and negative.
Okay. All right. Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right. Dan Feinberg is with us. You can read him on The Hollywood Reporter. He's a TV critic. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. All right. We've got to take a break here. We got weather and we got traffic, and then we'll talk more with Dan right here on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio, seventh floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m. And we're talking with Dan Feinberg, who is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan back to the show. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you much.
All right. I'm not, you know, I mean, you know I'm a Big Brother fan, but I'm not watching this Big Brother over the top on the CBS app. Have you seen any of it?
I have not either, because once they pushed back Star Trek, and once it became clear that the Good Wife sequel wasn't starting until the winter / early spring, I did not need to pay extra money for a CBS over-the-top service, which I believe still provides viewers with commercials even after they pay X amount of money.
Is that right?
I believe it is not a commercial-free service, and therefore you're just paying a lot, and currently you're paying a lot for CBS repeats and Big Brother over the top.
Okay. Well, now, in that vein, you are watching Survivor, the Millennials versus the Gen X. How's that been going?
I am indeed.
How's that been going?
It's been okay. When it just becomes Survivor, it's working out in the way that a Survivor season does. You know, there's a reason. There are some blindsides. There are some people who you love, some people you're rooting against. I wouldn't say it's been a great season, but I would say it's been a decent season with some memorable people. The theme was obnoxious and horrible, and not one that they ever need to repeat. And Jeff Probst's annoying insistence on bringing up the theme and making people describe their motivations in terms of how it stems from their being a Gen Xer or a millennial is really darned obnoxious. And the less it happens per episode, the better episodes are. But honestly, Survivor steers itself. And when I say steers itself, it has a marvelous team of editors and cinematographers and producers. So it really doesn't do anything by itself. It is a finely honed machine. But it is a machine that knows what it's doing at this point. So maybe this won't be a great season when all is said and done, and then on to the next season in the spring, and hope springs eternal. And that's what I like about it. It's much more reliable than most reality shows are.
Yeah. All right. 773 area code sends the text in. Is It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia returning for another season?
Always.
Yes.
Always. It's never going anywhere. The next season, it is a show that just continues, and it will be back for season 12 on January I'm going to say 4th. Let's pretend that's true.
Okay.
But it will be back for new episodes in January, early January for sure. 100% sure on that part. But then it's already been renewed for a 13th and a 14th season. So just going on forever.
Yeah.
And remarkable, and it is, of course, a show that is breaking records with its longevity, a bit like Simpsons, which also just got renewed for two more seasons, projecting way, way out into the future. And The Simpsons, as part of this renewal, is, I think, going to get to 660 episodes or something, 670 episodes. It's going to pass Bonanza. And It's Always Sunny is also breaking records for long running sitcoms, and really it's pretty remarkable, because you wouldn't have guessed either that the guys doing the show were going to want to keep doing it forever, and apparently they do, but you just wouldn't have expected that it was going to run this long. And Ozzie and Harriet is the show that holds the longest running live action comedy whatever, and the 14th season of Always Sunny will tie the Ozzie and
that
Harriet.
That is so hilarious that it's Ozzie and Harriet.
Ozzie and Harriet and It's Always Sunny will hold the record, and if the guys have any respect, they will walk away after 14 so that those two will be forever enshrined hand in hand.
That is fantastic. That is the best piece of trivia I've heard all week. I got to tell you, that is amazing. I love Sonny. I just think it's hilarious. And, you know, my ex-wife used to come in, and as I was watching it, she'd watch 5 minutes of it and go, how can you watch these people? How is it? How do you want to spend a half an hour with these people? So, and it's just, it's a divisive show, obviously, but I think it's great. I also love the fact Charlie Day was on Conan at one point and said he doesn't even think FXX knows that it's on the air.
I think they do. I think they appreciate it. I think that they are definitely not invested in making them change it in any way. I think they let them do exactly what they want to do. And I think that obviously has been to the show's benefit. In the article that I wrote about Atlanta and Better Things, about sort of formula-free comedy, I did note that while It's Always Sunny has a formula, it has deviated from that formula so frequently.
Oh, yeah.
And its best episodes are the episodes where it just goes off and does crazy things. And in the article, I mentioned that I don't know that any of these shows that take these risks have done anything as absurd and surreal as the season with Fat Mac.
Oh, my God. Yes.
where a co-creator and star of a show just decided he was going to gain 50 pounds for a season. Just because. He thought that would be an amusing thing to do for a season of television.
Just shooting up,
and so he did.
Shooting up insulin for a half an hour. That was an incredible season. Ridiculous. I want to mention.
Absolutely.
I want to mention Divorce on HBO. Divorce uses music beautifully. In every single episode, there's always a moment where they choose a song that's absolutely perfect. And, you know the songs that they use at the end credits of each episode have been great, too. And I'm loving Divorce. I think it's great. And I love the fact that they did a Christmas episode already. So have you been watching it?
I am two episodes behind, which means I've missed the Christmas episode. So I am looking forward to that. But it's a show I appreciate. It's a show I appreciate because of all the people who also don't like it.
Right.
I kind of appreciate the alienation that it produces some viewers.
It's funny. It's funny, Dan, because, you know, I do that, you know, Facebook thing where I let everybody know what I'm watching, because it's really important that people know what I'm watching on television. So I post that, and every single time I post that I'm watching Divorce, I get so many responses. How can you watch that show? It's so painful. So many people hate it. I revel in that, though. I think I've been divorced twice, and I think this show is a strong representation of what it's like.
I think it really does get to something squirmy and uncomfortable that a lot of people don't want to watch, and I think they don't want to watch it because it's recognizable, and I also totally understand why they don't want to watch it. And I respect it for wanting to do that. And I respect Sarah Jessica Parker for wanting to do something that potentially alienating. And it was just renewed last week as well. So
great.
We'll be back.
Yeah. All right, Dan, always a pleasure, my friend. Have a great Thanksgiving. And
yes, have a great Thanksgiving as well.
I'm off next week, but we'll talk to you the week when I'm back on 2 weeks from this morning.
Looking forward to it. Have a happy one.
All right. Thank you, Dan. Dan Feinberg, always a great guest, one of my favorites, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Facebook and Twitter. Read his stuff. He's a great writer. The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. All right, we got to take a break here. We got the news coming up next right here on 720 WGN.